This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome, everyone. I am super excited that you've joined us today. We have a great show lined up talking through how to improve your running biomechanics. I know a lot of you out there are probably like me, and you were a runner before you were a triathlete, or maybe you're a triathlete and you're a runner, and you want to know, like, how can I improve my form? How can I improve my technique? How can I get more efficient as a runner? And this episode is for you. My first guest joining us today is Coach Jeff Rains. Jeff has a master's of science in exercise physiology and has qualified for Boston multiple times. He has over 30 Ironman event finishes to his credit and was a D1 collegiate runner. Jeff, thanks for hopping back on the podcast to talk running.
Thank you, Andrew. Glad to be back. I'm excited to hit the ground running and dive deeper into my favorite, the run discipline.
I'm like guaranteed now. I'm just learning that every time Jeff Rains is on the podcast, there will be a bad pun right out of the gate. Like every single time. You have not let me down yet. Next up, hopefully without a bad pun, is pro triathlete Elizabeth James. Elizabeth is a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has a recent marathon PR of 3 hours and 59 seconds. Elizabeth is on a quest to complete a marathon in all 50 states, and with 18 states down, is already well on her way. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. The run is definitely my favorite discipline, so anytime we have the opportunity to sit down and talk about running, I am all for it.
And who am I? I am your host, Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people and captain of all of those in the middle of the pack. Today, we are going to start talking about Ironman race locations. Then we'll roll into the main set where I hope to cover all of the questions we as athletes have about running biomechanics. Then we'll cool down by hearing a TriDot athlete share the story about his first Ironman. It's going to be a good one. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Whether it's a 70.3 or a full-on 140.6, it feels like Ironman has been adding more new races than ever before. For today's warm-up, if you were in charge of picking the next location for an Ironman, in what city would you most want to see Ironman add a race? Elizabeth, I'm going to start with you. If you were in charge, 100% selfish reasons, you don't have to consider anybody else in your thinking, if you were going to go do a brand new Ironman race, what city would you want that race to be in?
Oh, gosh. Those that know me well know that geography is not my thing.
Did I stump you? Did I give you an impossible question?
Maybe so. I might need your help with what city this can be. I know, you know, the details of the course I want. I mean, I want a non-wetsuit legal down current river swim, a one loop bike course with some slightly rolling elevation, minimal turns, and then like a challenging and hot run course. I'm pretty indifferent with location. Maybe that's just because, like I said, geography is not my
thing. Elizabeth is there to race and win. She is not there to take in the sights.
All right, yeah. I mean, it's about the race, not the vacation there. But I'm not quite sure where that would be. So, you know, maybe our TriDot athletes can help me out with that. Tell me what location that would qualify for.
If Elizabeth's description fits a town or a city near you, let her know. Find her on Facebook. Find her on Instagram at Coach EJ, and be like, Elizabeth, this is where you need the race.
There we go.
This
yes.
is exactly what
they
you're
can help
talking.
Me out with the location.
Let's put Jeff's geography skills to the test a little bit. Jeff, do you actually have a city in mind when I ask this question?
Selfishly, I would love Austin, Texas. It's my backyard. The Longhorn Half Ironman used to be there. It moved to Waco. Great venue, but I would love a half or full Ironman event to be Estes Park, Colorado.
Oh.
Beautiful vacation place.
How many times have you been to Estes Park, Colorado?
I've been there 2 times.
Okay. And just loved it.
Loved it. And I would love to be out in that scenery. Crystal clear mountain water. Just amazing, amazing part of the Rockies.
Is that one of those Colorado cities that's like at elevation? Like, would that be like part of the difficulty of racing there, or is it low enough?
No, it's intense.
Is it?
Yes, yeah. It's going to be at altitude.
All right, well, that'd be super cool. I know for me, I thought long and hard about this, and I really wanted to pick something like exotic, like in the world. But what I have to go with, my family lives in Florida, and I did an Olympic distance race in Key West, Florida. And it was really a cool course. And the whole time I was out there, I just kept thinking to myself, man, it'd be so cool if there was a half or a full Ironman in Key West, Florida. I mean, they could market it as, you know, bottom of the country, come race an Ironman in the bottom of the country. It's the southernmost tip of the continental United States down in Key West. The road that takes you to Key West, it's just a one lane road, that goes all the way from the southern tip of Florida through all the Keys. And there's just multiple bridges that are just constantly connecting these little island to island to island. And so the whole 112 bike course could literally take you through all of the Keys and back, and you just be over the ocean the entire time. There literally is not a spot on the island of Key West, Florida, that does not have a view of the ocean. And so whether you're biking around it, running around it, swimming out in it, just a really, really unique island down there to, one, visit and be race in. So I really enjoyed my time doing an Olympic there with my dad. And the whole time, it was just like, man, it'd be super cool if there was a longer race here. I feel like it's a little bit of a challenge to get down there. You have to fly into Miami and drive down, but it's worth the travel. And that'd be my pick, is Key West. But, you know, in the spirit of us already wanting people to help Elizabeth, how about this? How about we have, if you're out there listening, you're part of our viewership, you're part of the Tridot family, just by listening to the podcast, we want to hear from you on this. Okay, so Elizabeth, she's looking at me right now. She's going to go on social media. She's going to go on the Tridot Facebook, the Tridot Instagram page, and post a question asking you guys where you would want to see Ironman put a race. You can pick your backyard. You can pick that scenic destination race in Europe or the islands or the beach where you've always wanted to go visit. You can pick wherever you would want to pick, and we would love to hear from you. And maybe someday on the podcast here in the near future, we'll pick a few and we'll share some of our favorite choices that you guys did. So go find us on Facebook, go find us on social media, and let us know where in the world you want to race an Ironman.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
All right, hypothetically, say the three of us are not in studio recording a podcast right now. Say we're in Boston, or Chicago, or Houston, or New York, on the day of a marathon, and we're watching some elite runners go by. You both turn to me, as running experts, and you say, "Hey, Andrew, look at that runner. Check out that beautiful form. Look at the stride." What do you see in their biomechanics that would make you point out a runner and just gush about how great their form is?
Oh, okay. Well, this doesn't take a whole lot of imagination, because I think both Reigns and I would say that when watching runners, that's one of the things that we look at quite a bit, and we do gush over and just go, "Oh gosh, their form, like, that's fantastic." I mean, really, it's kind of how the body, interacts as a whole. So beautiful form is kind of, you know, easy running. Those proper biomechanics just make running look effortless. Some trademarks of that effortless form are, you know, kind of a good upright body position with a slight forward lean, you know, a high cadence, minimal vertical oscillation, just kind of, you know, that stride that looks effortless.
Jeff, what about you?
You know, it's funny, because I'll notice an athlete and I can tell who they are before anyone else standing beside me on the sidelines can.
You mean like the pros, like the elites?
Yeah, and just anyone. My athletes, stud runners, you know, people that I'm looking for out on course or who I know are in the race, Before I can notice their face or their kit or something like that, I'll say, oh, that's Andrew Harley over there. You know, I can notice and tell people by who they are.
Jeff, when we run together, are you inwardly critiquing my form?
I do it, and I can't help it. I can't help it. I do it to everybody. I'm driving to Walmart or the grocery store, whatever, and I see somebody running on the sidewalk, and I'm like, oh, they're in the Brooks Ghost shoe, 12-millimeter drop. Oh, that right arm's doing something funky. You know, I just can't help it. I've done that
with my wife. We've been driving down the road, and there's a lot of parks where we live, like near the lake that we live near, and I've seen people out running. And I'm not nearly as nuanced as you are, but if I see something obvious, like someone just is really like picking their feet up unnecessarily high, like a crazy kick or a crazy arm swing, like I'll be like, oh man, that girl's really got a lot going on with her arms, like, and I'll make little comments, and it's just you can't help but not notice it, right? Like if you see somebody. It is going to be a Friends reference, but if you see somebody Phoebe buffeting it down the road, like you can't not notice. And if you don't get that reference, please like go on YouTube and find. I'm sure that's on there somewhere because it's hilarious. But anyway, so what are you looking for when you're looking for good form, Jeff?
Just like Elizabeth said, that effortless, kind of calm, cool, and collected style. Somebody who looks like they're running fast, but it looks like they're also, out on a joyride or a joy run. And it's even kind of like swimming sometimes. You look at someone and you're like, man, they're so calm, cool, and collected. They're not swimming that hard, but
yeah.
they're on world record pace, you know?
Yeah, and you look at the time clock, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, the people that fly by me in open water swims, like it looks like they're just gliding, right? It's crazy. And so running, it's much the same way, you're saying?
Yeah, there's an efficiency aspect that you can just tell. I mean, there's a million things to look for, you know, arm carriage, stride length, body lean, the amount of sound or, you know, that you hear from pounding and from breathing, ground contact, you know, overstriding. There's a ton of things that you look for when looking or assessing somebody's gait. But that just overall beautiful form is just something that you can tell. They're running fast, but they're not laboring that hard. They could hold that all day. At least it seems like or looks like they could.
So most of us are not at the place of the hypothetical marathon runner we're talking about that would cause you guys to just gush over their form. Most of us have significant room for improvement in our running form. So how can someone diagnose what they might be doing wrong in their running biomechanics?
You know, running is one of those things that some athletes think that they really don't need any guidance on. You place one foot in front of the other and you just keep going. I think there's even a really funny How I Met Your Mother episode about this when Barney decides to do a race. So, you know, as we're going with those Friends references, gosh, this is another good one, too, to look
Lots
up.
Lots of TV running episodes. Yeah. I'll throw another one out there in New Girl. The character Schmidt
is always out going
for a run, right? And then Nick joins him once in a while and gets sweaty really fast. And anyway.
Yeah. But, I mean, you place one foot in front of the other, you keep going. But there is a lot more to it than just that. And, you know, proper run form will not only make you a more efficient runner, which means a faster runner, but it's also going to keep you healthy and in the sport a lot longer. So for athletes that are looking to improve their run form, I highly recommend doing a run form analysis. Feedback from an expert coach is going to be very valuable for diagnosing areas for form improvement. I know that we're going to, you know, talk through some of those areas here today on the episode, but certainly the best feedback and my advice would be to get a formal run analysis.
Yeah, you know, I think so many people, I hear them say, well, I'm just not designed to be a runner, or you know, my parents didn't give me genetics that are in favor of me being just a one of those runners. You know, being an efficient runner and being a world-class athlete are two different things. You don't have to be super, super fast, but you can be very, very efficient.
Yeah.
So a lot of it depends your goal. Are you just trying to go out and finish that 5K? So you may not be as interested in correcting or improving on your biomechanics, but everybody's goal should be to prevent injury, to be a little bit more efficient.
So I know this can vary from runner to runner and problem to problem, but in general, what are some of your go-to drills for improving your running form?
Okay, so this is perfect because for all of the TriDot athletes listening, the go-to or tried-and-true run drills, those that are really going to help improve your run form, those are already included in the run workouts.
In the warm-up portion, is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So people don't skip those.
They are there for a reason,
yeah.
And those are a critical part of your workout.
When I first started on TriDot, I would see those and I would think, oh, I'll just, you know, just to save time, I'll just replace those with just 2-3 minutes of just jogging the warm up, and I won't go through all those. Like they feel in a way kind of elementary, like, you know, all the different skips and the bounds, and then I went to a camp, and at that camp, they had a coach kind of walking us through some of those and kind mm-hmm. of talking about the importance of those. And it made me realize, like, oh, those are really for a reason. So I started doing them, not every time I go for a run, but like I should. But most of the time, I take the time to go through those warm-ups, and it has really made a big difference in the way I'm driving my knee through my stride and all of that. So I think that's a great point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that a lot of athletes are in that same situation that, you know, even if they see them there, are they really doing them? This is something I challenge my coached athletes on frequently. Have you done your run drills? Okay, let's make a challenge this week. Everybody, like, chime in once you've done your run drills. Like, let's hear about it. Let's see some pictures, you know, encouraging one another that this is an important part of your run training as well.
I encourage a lot of my athletes, if you're pressed for time, cut your main set in half. I would rather you get that warm-up session in and even foam rolling recovery after. Don't cut the recovery off or the warm-up just because you want to see 180 heart rate and get that main set in. Sometimes you will become a better runner in the long haul, long run, if you focus on these key aspects.
And some of those drills are very tiring. I found myself getting sweaty and a little out of breath doing some of those warm-up drills.
I would say probably once every month at least, I will completely negate and skip my run workout for that day. And I will literally go to a football field or a track and I will spend 30, 45 minutes just doing drills.
So what are a few of those drills? Like, for people who are wondering, we keep saying that. And obviously people, you know, that if they've looked at their tried out workouts, they've seen some of those, but what are a few of the key ones, Jeff, that you would recommend people do on a day like that or before they go for a run?
There's a huge database of drills. You can Google it. You know, everyone's heard of high knees and butt kicks, but before I get into a couple specifics, I want to really touch on something. There are tons of different ways that you can warm up your body before exercise. You could heat up your muscles and create more elastic, better range of motion muscles by sitting in a hot tub, right? You could warm up our bodies.
That sounds nice.
We could, you know, we could do 100 push-ups, right? There's a ton of things that we can do to heat up and warm up our bodies. So why do essentially all the sports out there use run drills as their warm-up regimen?
Yeah, that's what we did in soccer and tennis when I was an athlete doing those. It was running warm-up drills, much of the same things we do with TriDot was what I did as a tennis player.
Yeah, because every sport involves movement, knowing your body, being in tune with your body. And so if all of these sports have kind of run-specific entities to it or aspects to it, doing run-specific drills, they kind of enhance and exaggerate good aspects of your run form. Okay, and they're designed to kind of over attenuate those good aspects in hopes to kind of reprogram neuromuscularly your improvements in gait and run mechanics. So if we exaggerate good movements and we do them regularly before and after every time we run, hopefully we are neuromuscularly relearning these good aspects, and it's spilling over into our workouts. You know, drills not only just warm you up, but they promote quick turnover. Shorter strides, higher cadence is key and crucial, especially for endurance. But longevity, efficiency, gosh, injury prevention, success building mileage or increasing into longer and longer distances. So all of these drills promote good aspects of your form when doing all of those things. So what are a couple of good go-to ones? A-skips. There's A, B, C, D skips. A skips is one of my go-to drills.
Also known as Andrew skips.
Andrew skips.
Yeah, A for Andrew there, obviously.
arm, it's more of an arm swing drill, believe it or not. And it focuses a little bit on knee drive, but all of these drills really promote landing on the ball of your foot, attenuating your arch. You can't do, let's just say, the everyone knows high knees, the drill. Try doing those on your heels, right? That quick turnover, that big high knee drive and landing on your heels, one, it hurts. Two, you'll go backwards. You won't move forward.
Wow.
You'll go backwards, right? So all of these drills promote really, really getting the most out of that elastic return and of the attenuated arch, right? That forward propulsion, efficient spring-like motion using our arches doing so. Windmills is a good drill. Really wakes up the hamstrings and that elastic return of the push-off, that kind of third and fourth stage of the stride, that flight phase. It's kind of how you propel and use the, you know, what they call ground reaction force to your advantage or to your favor. Shake-ups, I call it penguin run. You put your hands behind your back and you lean forward and you run with straight legs. It's kind of neat, but it focuses on body lean. C-skip is a drill that focuses on hip flexors. Skipping for height is a drill that focuses on kind of pushing up and off that big toe, not kind of bailing out and pushing off of that pinky toe, bounding like a deer. Those are drills that prepare you for hills or big efforts. I mean, every drill has a specific aspect of your form that it's kind of waking up, getting ready for that future workout.
So I know both of you have worked super hard over the years to hone in your own running form, and in a lot of ways you still are. What was maybe a bad habit that you worked to fix in your own running stride?
So, yeah, when you say, you know, what have we worked on or are we still working? I'm definitely still working a lot on my run form and particularly working on my cadence. I know that, you know, still when I get tired, I go back to bad habits. My stride gets really long. My cadence gets pretty slow. My husband is such a great supporter of all my racing, and he'll often get some videos of me as I am nearing the finish line. And when I go back and watch those videos later, it kind of makes me cringe. I'm looking at those final strides, and it really highlights that this is still an area of improvement for me. So working on my cadence is kind of a big thing. That's also going to kind of translate into another area of improvement for me, which is my vertical oscillation. So kind of like my cadence, this deteriorates at the end of my race. I'd bounce kind of up and down a whole lot more, and I need to be using that energy for forward motion. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a continual learning progress, and those are a couple things I'm still working on.
So it's working on taking the good form you have honed in on the track and just being able to continue it all the way through the duration of your race.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a while to break some of those bad habits. And when I am very focused on my running form, I'm able to kind of put into practice the things I've been working on. But I can tell that as I get near the end of an event and my focus is not on necessarily my running form as much as it was earlier or as it is in my training sessions, then I still kind of revert back to some of those older habits. So I'm still working to make that a part of my, you know, race form as well.
And that's a great thing to keep in mind too, because I think people forget that when you are working on very mindfully, very intentionally working to improve an aspect of your running stride, you know, you can work on it in your training sessions and feel like, oh, you know, in a few sessions, I've really worked on this. I've really accomplished something. I'm really doing better. But it's not just enough just to practice it 2, 3, 4, 5 times. It's really got to get where it's second nature, or in the later stages of your race, it is going to start breaking down. Jeff, what's something that for you that you've really worked on your own time?
First of all, I have to add to something Elizabeth said earlier, that as those race photo pictures you get the week after a race, you know, the first 4 or 5, I'm smiling, I'm happy, I look good.
I'm having a good time.
So many, yeah. And then
I'm shooting little finger pistols at the photographer and giving peace signs and high fives.
And then here comes the second half of the photo reel, and I look like Rocky Balboa at the end of a fight. My face is just in agony. I look horrible. One of my weaknesses, I hunch. I lean forward, the shoulders roll forward. You know, I look like I'm kind of pushing a walker,
okay.
You know, and I just, I look very inefficient. I hunch over, I lose that good erect, just kind of, kind of that good, you know, center of mass aspect of my form. And so,
is there anything you do in your own run training to try to improve upon that, or is it just the later stages of a race? It's just bound to happen.
Yeah, what I'll do is I have to earn more miles to my long run.
Okay.
And so I look at a lot of my data at the end of a long run, and if my cadence has fallen and some of these aspects we're about to dive into, if my data is bad the second half of a run, then I'm not allowed to add 2 miles to my long run next week or the one thereafter. I have to have good data at the current distance that I'm at before I have earned more volume.
So it's adding quality miles and not just adding miles.
Exactly.
So I often see people argue over what is the perfect running cadence. You guys have both touched on cadence just a little bit. So tell me this, is there such thing as the perfect running cadence?
You know, you would think so based on everything you see online. I definitely have my input on this. So if you were to Google right now, perfect running cadence, 180 is probably the number you're going to see. 90 steps per minute on 1 foot. So the total steps taken in a 1 minute period on average throughout the duration of whatever run you're doing, 180 tends to be the norm. You know, just like, gosh, not everybody will race, let's just say, you know, Google will even say, okay, you're training for a half Ironman, so you will race approximately 80% of your FTP for that 56-mile bike portion. Well, just like not everybody is going to race exactly 80%, you know, what if there's hills, what if there's wind, so not everybody has the same fitness level, not everybody should or could achieve a perfect 180. I find that a range is the norm based on my experience. The range being 160 to 180. Okay, so 80 to 90 steps per minute.
Athlete is landing in that range, that becomes a cadence isn't an issue for them. You're saying that if they're in that range, they're doing a good job with their cadence.
They're doing a good job, yes, but the goal is always to have, like, the long story short, I'll say the secret to running is shorter stride, higher cadence.
Okay.
So what is that cadence? Why not 200? Why not 190? We're going to touch on just a second. But 160 to 180, you're doing an efficient job. The goal should always be on the higher end of that range. Now, I'm a decent runner, you know, for what it's worth. I averaged a 168 cadence in the Houston Marathon recently. And, you know, I'm a run coach, and if you see 180 everywhere, you know, the higher end of that range, which you would think 170, 180, right? That's the top half of that range. Why am I okay with the 168? Well, a lot of it depends on your personal physiology. Really, really tall athletes tend to have a hard time achieving higher cadences. Really, really short athletes tend to be able to hit that 180, even 190 pretty easily without having to think about it or work. Now, I'm 5'9". I'm not tall. I'm not super short. You know, why am I still okay with a 168 average for a marathon? Well, a lot of that is your unique torso to kind of leg height or leg length ratio. I have a very tiny torso, very little body, but I have really long legs.
So it's kind of like you have the legs of a much taller guy.
Yeah, maybe my body thinks I'm 6'6". I don't know. But I have a very long stride. I have very long legs compared to my torso. And so 168, you know, knock on wood, I've been injury-free for 10-plus years. I have some decent personal best for me, at least. And so that 168 range tends to be where I fall for those really long distances. Just kind of make sure that you're also taking into account, acceleration changes. You know, what if the 8 mile loop, let's say that you ran, was really hilly, or there were a lot of headwinds, maybe there were a lot of turns, cornering, changing your speeds a lot inside of that run, all these things, terrain, environmental conditions, they all have an impact on kind of how you fluctuate inside of the ranges of your cadence. So you've got to think about all of that. There's always a story, you know, how are you feeling? You know, maybe what shoe are you in? Did you run with a hydration backpacker belt? Did you add weight to your body? All these things will affect your cadence.
So that range is kind of the sweet spot. And within that range, if you have a body type that can get closer to that 180, then that's what we want to strive for. But if you're in there, you're pretty much doing a good job, is kind of what we're saying.
Yes, if I had to put a number on it, and you know, 160 to 180 is the goal. And we'll dive in a little bit more
and
later.
Part of it's knowing your body, kind of some of the things you pointed out, whether you have longer legs, shorter legs. And this is something you mentioned, too, that I want to expound a little bit more on is that speed you're talking about. Because when we're racing, you know, especially the longer the course, you know, we're probably trying to hold a pretty steady effort. But there's times in races where we're going to surge a little bit. There's times where maybe we're doing a local sprint and we're holding a fast pace, and we get to the last half mile and we've got some gas left in the tank and we want to speed up to hit, you know, a certain time, or maybe this, Jeff, maybe I'm out on course and I see somebody pass me and on their leg, they're in my age group. And so I want to surge to keep up with them and maybe pass them back. So if we're changing speeds within our races, does our cadence also change along with it? Or are we trying to keep a similar cadence?
The good old speed versus cadence debate, or million-dollar question: does cadence change as speed changes? It's a yes and no. It is a little bit of a trick question. If I had to pick one of those two, I would say the answer is no. Your cadence should not change as your speed changes. But let me explain. When you accelerate, when you go from a slower speed to a much faster speed, your cadence will increase. It will raise a little bit. Now, once you're at that top speed or that goal speed you want to attain, that will settle back down into that 160 to 180 range.
Interesting.
So, for example, let's say you went out and you ran a 12-minute mile. You should stay, you know, or average, let's say, in between that 160 to 180. Maybe closer to 180 is the goal. So maybe you're shooting for 180 cadence at, let's say, a slightly slower 12-minute mile. You would think, though, that if, okay, well now, you know, Coach Jeff wants me to go run a 9-minute mile on a track,
my legs should speed up to hit that 9-minute mile.
Yeah, I have to speed up. I have to work harder. I have to run faster to achieve a 9-minute mile instead of a 12-minute mile. You should still take the same amount of number of steps to achieve that mile.
So am I just taking longer steps at that point and leaning farther forward? How am I achieving that speed if I'm not raising my cadence?
You're hitting the ground harder, but you're traveling further within each step. But you should still take about the same amount of number of steps. So you would think that running a 12-minute mile, you achieved 180, you know, steps per minute. But if you were to go run a faster 9-minute mile, would you take 200 steps per minute to achieve that because you're running faster? So you would think that, but the answer is no. Now, I find that it's a trick question because does your speed change or does your cadence change as your speed changes? Yes and no. The real answer is no, but I find that you should not see more than about a 5 to 8 cadence increase or differential from that baseline, from that kind of 9 to 12 minute mile. Now, it is kind of deemed that kind of 6:30, 7 minute mile or faster. You know, those guys running 4 minute miles, their cadence will be a little bit higher. That's not an endurance, so to speak, a long distance, all day long pace. But for the most part, that 7 minute mile to 15 minute mile, your cadence should not change much, for sure. No more than 5 to 8 as your speed changes.
And if I could, I would just love to interject here for a second. I saw this fantastic demonstration that my run coach did a couple years ago, and it was just exactly what we were talking about here. What happened was he kind of gathered us all around a treadmill. He set a metronome to 180. And then he, you know, started running. He varied the pace on the treadmill. So kind of like Rains was saying, he started at a 12-minute mile and was able to keep that 180 cadence. And then he increased the speed. And he showed us, okay, you know, I went from a 12-minute mile. Now I'm here at a 10-minute mile. Cadence hasn't changed. Still right on beat with the metronome. And again, he went, you know, all the way down to, gosh, I think it was like a 6-minute mile or something. And the entire time keeping the same cadence. Now, you know, here and there was maybe a little fluctuation with an acceleration.
Yeah.
But then always was able to settle in exact same cadence and just really was a fantastic demonstration about no matter what you're running, paces, you can still have that high cadence.
You're not moving your legs any faster. You're pushing a little bit harder, but you're not going any faster. That's super interesting. So let's move on to this one though. Let's talk for a minute about arm swing. Now I've heard it's good to use your arms to kind of help propel you forward, But I've also heard it's good to kind of keep your arms more tucked in so that you're more efficient, you're saving energy. What should we be doing with our arms while we run?
We definitely want to use that arm swing as kind of a momentum and balancing aspect, but lower relaxed shoulders and very calm arm swing is key. Now, if I had to put a number on it, I would say kind of an 80 to 90 degree arm swing at the elbow flexion, so that 90 degree elbow angle is recommended for most. So 80 to 90 degrees, we swing at our shoulders, not at our elbows. I use the analogy of kind of like a rusted hinge, right? Our elbows are a rusted hinge. We swing more from the shoulders. Now I will say that in the sport of triathlon, a lot of people will, and some coaches even coach to stay on the narrower or more acute or inside of that arm angle range.
So have your arms more tucked than 90 degrees.
A little bit more tucked because we have already swam. We've already biked. We're fatigued, right? We may want to overlean a little bit. We're tired. We need to stay erect. So we want to keep our shoulders low and relaxed. But a lot of triathletes will close the arms just a little bit kind of inside of that ideal 80 to 90 degrees to keep their upper bodies more erect when they're fatigued going into a long run. But for the most part, 80 to 90 degrees is ideal. Running, uphill versus downhill, uphhill they'll close a little bit, downhill they'll open a little bit. But something I want to talk about as far as arm swing, when I coach kids especially, I've even done this before. I've brought marbles. I have them grab a marble and put it in the fist. They make a fist and they hold a marble in the palm of their hand. Now, I get this question a lot as far as arm swing. So we know we want more of an 80 to 90 degree arm swing, low relaxed shoulders and all of that stuff. But how high does the fist come up? How far does the fist go in the back, towards your hip, past your butt, in the back of the arm swing? So I use this analogy. All right, so if you put marbles in your fists.
Or an energy gel.
Or anything. Yeah.
Might as well have it be something useful on your run.
The highest point at which you would want that marble to come up, if you're maintaining an 80 to 90 degree arm swing throughout the entire stride or in an arm swing phase, we don't want that marble to come up higher than the breast line. I think textbook's kind of that xiphoid process, the hard collection of bone there, just on
that's
your lower
what that's
breast
called?
Line.
yes.
If I've learned anything today, it's that's what it's. So say it again. The little hard part, kind of in the middle of your sternum, is the what?
Xiphoid process.
Oh my gosh!
Say that five times fast. But anyways, we don't want that marble to come up higher than that lower breast line. We're not punching ourselves in the chin, punching the sky.
So we do want our arms to help us drive forward. But if we're going above that line, you're going overboard with that.
Correct. You're not using the full effect of that forward momentum. So, okay. So we don't want the marbles to come up kind of higher than that lower chest line, breast line. We don't want the marbles to go further back than maybe our pocket. I've heard people say, kind of, eat that cookie, get off me. A famous run coach down in Austin says that. And
eat that cookie being bringing the cookie
bringing
up to your mouth.
That cookie up closer to your mouth. Get off me, throw that elbow back. So just kind of encouraging that 80 to 90 degree arm swing is kind of what that means. Now, we know that marble doesn't come up higher than our lower breast line, but worst case scenario, we don't want those marbles to twist or cross that front center line, but the upper body will twist a little bit. So that arm will come up and across the front of the body a little bit as that spine twists. But worst case scenario, kind of if we draw vertical lines kind of on our nipple line, our breast line, we don't want the marbles to come up higher than, let's just say, that nipple mark or inside of that mark. But worst case scenario, the midline. We don't want the marbles to cross through that midline. Now, uphills, the arm carriage will be a little bit tighter. You were mentioning kind of bringing that arm swing in, being a little bit more efficient. On an uphill, we're hurting. We want to get up to the top as fast as we can. So that arm carriage will be a little bit tighter and slightly higher with the fists as we're running uphill. And then downhill, they might be a little bit lower. So for steady state, flat terrain, those are pretty much the textbook norms.
Now, earlier you mentioned body lean, Is there an ideal amount that we should all be leaning forward into our stride? And how can we know if we're doing that right while we're running?
So this is going to vary a little bit as to kind of what your purpose for that run session was, or if you're racing. So that forward body lean is going to look a little bit different if you're doing a steady state long run versus your speed work, or, you know, if you're making some accelerations. I mean, think about Usain Bolt coming out of the blocks on his 100 meter dash. That is going to look a whole lot different in terms of body lean.
That dude is leaned halfway to the finish line.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Out of the blocks.
I mean, that looks completely different than me on my long run. Two completely different scenarios there. You know, if we had to put some specific numbers on it for a reference point, you know, about 4 to 8 degrees of a forward body lean, the elites tend to be kind of on the lower end of that spectrum, but everyone is going to kind of reach closer to that 6 to 7 degrees or so while on the ground, kind of transferring that energy for their forward propulsion.
Another huge aspect of all the sports you do in triathlon, swimming, biking, and running, but really on the run, especially the way we breathe can be super helpful. We've got to get oxygen to our muscles. We've got to get oxygen pumping through our body. You know, we've got to stay in control of our breath. Is there an ideal kind of way or method or approach to breathing while we're running?
You know, I think that we've heard a lot growing up in sports, even peewee football and baseball. You know, I've heard of, you know, breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. Now that's probably recommended for more zone two, kind of longer, slower, steady state runs. Our heart rates aren't super high. We can get away with breathing out of kind of a straw versus a garden hose. What I recommend as far as breathing, a pursed lip exhale, okay? Letting that exhale be a longer duration than the inhale. If I was to jump out and startle you and clap and you could gasp and scream like a little girl, maybe, Andrew, you can maximally inhale in a split second. Now, I could slowly let that breath out, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, maybe even 45 seconds. So a pursed lip exhale enhances endurance performance. How does it do that? By doing that longer, and again, this is more steady state zone two, but it gradually relaxes your diaphragm. It promotes more efficient fat burns, kind of that slow burning candle, so to speak. So at those types of efforts, we want that longer, slower, pursed lip exhale in through the nose, out through the mouth. Now, as we start transitioning into in more intensive workouts, zone three, especially zone four, zone five, more anaerobic energy systems are being utilized. Respiratory rates are going higher. At that point, higher heart rate zones, kind of that maybe 160 or even higher 180 heart rate, breathing in through your mouth and out through your mouth is key. You know, why breathe through that straw when you can breathe through a garden hose?
At that point, it's less about keeping your composure and more about just getting the oxygen.
Yeah, I mean, breathe how your body's telling you to breathe. I used to think that if I kind of held my breath a little bit, it might kind of calm my heart rate down and maybe that.
Nope.
No. And then you could argue, well, hey, you know, my buddy or that rival, let's say, is coming up next to me or I'm coming up on him. I'm going to calm my breathing down or almost hold my breath a little bit. So I let them think.
I got to psych them out.
Yeah, I'm psyching them out. I'm cool. I'm not tired. I'm not hurting at all. But really on the inside, I'm screaming. But I used to think that kind of holding your breath and quietly breathing. Don't be afraid to breathe how your body's telling you to breathe. Just don't hyperventilate while doing that.
Now, runners can be identified as heel strikers, midfoot strikers, or forefoot strikers. And when they look for, when we go out and look for our next pair of running shoes, sometimes you'll see, you know, people talk about, oh, you know, this shoe's good for this and this shoe's good for that. And we're identified as that based on where your foot hits the ground during your stride. Is one of these landing styles better than the others?
So that's kind of a tough question. And I think kind of the best way for us to approach this is by talking a little bit about those different landing styles first. So to kind of go through the entire running cycle, you know, starting with where the contact is made with the foot on the ground. So the foot contact should occur kind of on that outside edge of the foot and depending on the speed, either at the midfoot or the forefoot. So what we see with a heel strike results in a higher braking force, which reduces the elastic energy storage and has a prolonged ground contact time. By hitting with either the forefoot or the midfoot, that braking action is minimized, and kind of that initial impact peak is also reduced.
Yeah, you know, I think that heel striking has gotten a bad rap. I will say the majority of runners are heel strikers.
I was in a race one time. It's funny you say that because I was racing just a local sprint, and I remember like halfway through the run, it was just a 5K, but there was this guy who was just crushing it. And like he was on loop two, there were some of us still on loop one, and he goes flying by, and one of the runners next to me like yelled out at him like, "Hey man, great job! You're still on your toes. You look great." Like it's glorified to like run more on your midfoot or toes, and people I think that land on their heel, it's kind of the looked down upon, right? As, oh, I'm just a heel striker, and it's got that reputation.
It does have that reputation, and it's gotten a bad rap. Now, let's say that you're really late into your run career, you don't want to switch to that ideal midfoot strike. Heel striking is okay. Midfoot running is ideal, but heel striking is okay.
And it's ideal. Why? Is it that much more efficient? Is it just so your foot's on the ground less time?
Like it's called ground reaction force.
Okay.
But there's an equal and opposite reaction up your tibia, your shin bone. So whatever angle that tibia is at when your foot impacts the ground, that loading phase that Elizabeth was referring to, whatever angle that tibia is at that peak impact period, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if I'm overly reaching my stride and I'm overly heel striking and my heel or my foot, it's your instep or your arch, but the midfoot, wherever that point is, if it's too far reached out in front of your center of mass, that's a no-no. So we want that impact to be under our plumb line center of mass. So if we were to freeze frame our bodies running in front of a camera from a side view and we drew a plumb line, that plumb line should hit five main points of contact on the body: the head, the chest, kind of the belly button, hips. We don't want there to be a huge gap between that plumb line and our belly button. We want to run erect.
So all those things should be in alignment, basically.
Yes, you should be able to draw a line kind of in the front of your body, and your forehead hits perfectly on that plumb line, your chest, your hips, your belly button, your knee, and then ideally your midfoot or that instep. Right. And so if we're reaching too far out in front of that, and whether we're heel striking or midfoot running at that point, if it's under the center of mass plumb line or just a few inches out in front, we'll get to that in a second. But goal ideal is that foot strike, that impact should be under that center of mass plumb line.
So the goal really, it's less the biomechanical sin, so to speak, is less about landing on your heel, and it's more about landing with your foot far out in front of that plumb line.
Yes. Now, let's... it's called gazelles versus gliders. You can be a heel striker and still be fast. You can be a heel striker and still be injury-free. Midfoot running will give more of an attenuated arch. But to be fast as a heel striker, you would have to increase your cadence above that 180. Let me give you a quick example. There's a video on YouTube. It's amazing. Miranda Carfrae versus Chrissy Wellington. They're both Kona winners, female.
Top-notch, renowned runners.
Yes, if you've been in the triathlon world more than a day, you've probably heard those names. But they have both won Kona many times. They have both won with a 252 marathon. So Miranda Carfrae would be that kind of gazelle, that midfoot runner, that beautiful Kenyan-esque type of gait. She would be that ideal triathlon midfoot runner. Chrissy Wellington looks like she, you know, could be a little bit in pain, looks like she's running slower than she really is, but she has also run a 252 marathon.
Wow.
At the end of an Ironman and has won numerous times. So, that kind of proves, I guess, in so many ways that you can still be fast, you can still be world-class injury-free.
And you can still be more of a heel striker.
Yes, you're going to have a shorter stride and higher cadence while heel striking to be injury-free and to be that fast. So just as long as the cadence is there, heel striking is fine, but midfoot running is ideal.
So when we get tired, you know, our form really starts to break down naturally. And Jeff, you touched on this earlier. Like, you know, it's an issue for you. You start slouching a little bit. And Elizabeth, you know that for you, you start slowing down that cadence and lengthening out that stride. And so let's maybe leave everybody with this, because we all get in our races, and you know, maybe we're going through our drills and our workouts, and so we're improving our form, and our form's pretty good when we're mindful of it or when we're early in a race. But when we're late in the race and we're getting tired and our form starts breaking down, what is maybe that tip you would give an athlete for retaining your form through the later stages of a race when you start getting tired?
There's a couple quick things, you know, that can kind of bring back that pep in your step, right? I like to think lift, lift, lift. Just that simple. It's that simple. Well, first of all, the last thing I'm thinking of in the middle of a race is, oh man, is my body lean in that, you know, kind of, you know, 2 to 4 to 6, you know, am I overleaning, you know, what's my arm carry?
Is this 7% or is this 9% of a lean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, is my arm at 80 to 90 degrees? Is my cadence, you know, this? Those are the last things you're thinking about.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about queso at the finish line. I'm thinking about laying on that couch. Get me out of this agony, right? But, you know, in a nutshell, some things that can, you know, really.
So thinking lift, 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 that's just, is that kind of lift your head, lift your body up, you know, try to keep yourself feeling light? Or is that lifting your knee and continuing to drive it? Or is just all of the above?
It can be all of those things. You know, just thinking lift will keep that cadence high. That's the biggest thing. Shorter stride, higher cadence. When you get tired, you overstride. It's human nature to reach out and grab more distance. Overreaching is that from the knee down, that lower leg reaching out and grabbing more distance. Everyone does it, the second half of a long run. So thinking lift will lift those knees, it will increase the cadence, it will get me more erect, I'm not gonna hunch forward, all of those things. Now, if I had to kind of, you know, put it all in just a quick, like, what is perfect running form? Just in 10 seconds, what is perfect running form? Or what can I at least think of in the middle of a race to bring me back, right? You know, if I had to write a book about it, if I had to put numbers on it all, I would say 80 to 90 steps per minute. That's your cadence, right? 160, 180 with 2 feet. 80 to 90 degree arm swing. So 80 to 90 steps, 80 to 90 degree arm swing. 2 to 4 inches of vertical oscillation. We don't want to be greater than 10 centimeters or approximately 4 inches. That's wasted upper movement. Kind of the same idea, 2 to 4 inches. We don't want our foot to reach out and land more than 2 to 4 inches, worst case scenario, out in front of that center of mass plumb line we were talking about. So 2 to 4 is easy there for vertical oscillation and center of mass. We got the 80 to 90 rule there we just talked about.
And all these numbers, I mean, they're specific. And if you're not a very, very nuanced, you know, runner who's used to diving into those numbers, that you hear that and you're like, well, wait, what? But people need to realize, if you look on your Garmin or your Strava, like, those numbers are there for you to kind of analyze after your workouts. And so if you start paying attention to it, you can kind of start learning, oh, I didn't realize that my vertical oscillation was greater than 4. Now, after hearing Jeff Raines talk about it, I can work on, you know, not bouncing as high when I run. And so those are great tools to kind of look on Garmin and kind of see what you're doing.
Yeah, after you do a workout, you go home and you look at your data, and there's tons of numbers and things on the lower end of those screens that most people have no idea what they mean, how to interpret it. So having a coach interpret that and giving you some of those, you know, those feedback tidbits are priceless.
And when all else fails, lift, lift, lift.
Lift, lift, lift. Ninja feet, you know, quiet feet, you know, the pursed lip exhale, low relaxed shoulders. So hopefully some of these things that we repeated over and over again stick with you guys. And hopefully some of these tidbits helped.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
For our cool down today, we are going to do something that we call the TriDot Top 10, where we make or share a fun list of 10 things from the multi-sport world. Today, we want to give a shout-out to the top 10 countries listening to the TriDot podcast. Look, when we first started this thing, we just hoped that it would be helpful just for everyday triathletes all over the world. And guys, we have been overwhelmed with the response since launching the podcast. At the time of this recording, We have listeners from 90 countries worldwide, and we don't have time, of course, to call all of them out by name. So I just want to say that wherever you are, thanks so much for being a part of the podcast family. We are glad you are here. We value you. And if your home country isn't called, maybe, you know, share us with your friends and see if you can get yourself into the top 10 next time. After all, right now, the difference between 10th and 11th on the list is just three downloads. All right, let's get to the top 10. The United States is the number one country that is downloading the Trot Out podcast. So shout out to the US of A. Elizabeth, what is number two?
All right, not a surprise here either. Canada comes in at number two.
A lot of Trot Out athletes go up into Canada for Mount Tremblant and some of the other races up there. I personally have a couple Canadian Trot Out friends. So thank you, Canada, for listening. Jeff, what is number three?
Australia.
The Aussies. Everybody loves the Aussies. Number four, right next door, is New Zealand. My first half Ironman was half Ironman New Zealand. So for all of our Kiwis out there, I visited Auckland. I visited Taupo. I visited some of the towns in between on that drive. And, man, just absolutely loved my time in New Zealand. So thanks so much for listening. Elizabeth, what's number five?
Number five is the UK.
The UK. Wonderful. Jeff, what about number six?
United Arab Emirates.
Number seven is Spain. Elizabeth, number eight.
Also a neighbor here for us, Mexico.
Mexico. Jeff, we get into Europe for number nine as well, right?
Yes, sir. Germany.
Jeff and I, this is a quick side story. Jeff and I at IMAZ met a German athlete. We were filming some Trot Out athletes on the IMAZ bike course, getting ready for the race. And a guy, Joachim from Germany, came up and was like, hey, do you mind taking a couple pictures of me on my bike while I'm out here? And we did, and we have a new friend from Germany. So if he's listening, shout out to Joachim. Number 10 on the list is France. So all the French athletes listening to us on the podcast, thank you so much. And we value all the countries that listen in. And so, guys, before we go, I want you both to give a shout out to another country on the list. Not in the top 10. This is kind of some bonus mentions. Elizabeth, what is another country in our 52 country listener base that you want to give a shout out to?
Well, for me, it's Switzerland. Been there before, just beautiful. So when I saw that on the list, they were going to be my shout out.
Wonderful. Swiss athletes, thank you so much for listening. Jeff, who do you want to give a shout out to?
Cambodia. We have listeners from Cambodia. I thought that was great.
The Kingdom of Cambodia. I do want to distinguish. We use a platform called Simplecast to host our podcast episodes, and Simplecast refers to it as the Kingdom of Cambodia. So the one I'm going to pick, and I picked it for the same reason, Simplecast, it's Greece. And on Greece, it calls it the Hellenic Republic. And I thought that was super awesome that it wasn't just Greece, it was the Hellenic Republic. So all of my Greek listeners, I have been to your country. I loved your country. Your food is my favorite. And that's all for now. So moving on. A big goal for us is to share more athlete stories on the podcast, and we would love to have athletes from our worldwide audience outside of the States also join in to tell us their try stories. If that sounds like fun to you, head to trydot.com/podcast and click on Submit Feedback and let me know where in the world you are from and what you're thinking of the podcast. We would love to get some more athletes on the podcast soon. Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Trot Out coaches Jeff Rains and Elizabeth James for giving us some clutch information about improving our running biomechanics. Have any triathlon questions or topics you want to hear us talk about? Head to trotout.com/podcast to let us know what you're thinking. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to